going very, very slowly because the temperatures are just nasty cold.
Extreme weather slows work at the Well Blowout site on the North Slope. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 29th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska's Chief Justice makes the case for a new approach in the legal system.
The idea that jail time is the fitting response to every crime, or even to most crimes, has become an expensive and a possibly unnecessary proposition.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. ConocoPhillips, the easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
It's been 2 weeks since the Spanish company Repsol suffered a blowout at an exploratory well on the North Slope. The company still doesn't have control of the well, and extreme weather is slowing that work. The well is no longer active, but environmental groups say the harsh conditions that are hampering the cleanup operation prove how difficult it is to work in the Arctic. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Workers on the drilling rig have been struggling with temperatures as low as minus 49 degrees and wind chills of minus 74. Kathy Forrester with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission says equipment can't operate outside when it's that cold.
It's going very, very slowly because temperatures are just nasty cold. I think yesterday with the wind chill, it was minus 71 degrees Fahrenheit. And when it's that cold, you just can't do much.
Repsol has filed a plan to kill the well with the commission. Forrester says her team has reviewed that plan and is satisfied with it. But before they can kill the well, they need to finish steam thawing the massive amount of drilling mud that's frozen to the rig. Forrester doesn't have an estimate on when that process will be complete. She says it's frustrating it's taking so long, but the well is no longer dangerous.
It's not concerning to the ALGCC from a well control perspective because the well is dead now, and going slow isn't going to hurt anything. The only concern would be from Repsol's perspective that it's costing a lot of money.
Repsol won't put a dollar figure on how much it's costing. Jan Sieving is vice president of public affairs for Repsol USA. She says it's been an arduous process trying to get the rig back in working order again.
So it's just a challenging environment up there between the remoteness and then the, you know, extreme cold temperatures. So I think we've been careful all along not to speculate as to when, you know, the well would be officially secured.
Environmental groups are concerned the company still hasn't been able to gain control of the well. Lois Epstein is an engineer who works for the Wilderness Society. She says the company should have been ready to deal more efficiently with the conditions they're encountering on the North Slope.
I almost think it's like a Homer Simpson question, you know, duh, it's cold on the North Slope. Everybody should have been prepared for that, prepared for freezing temperatures. And they are having trouble, from what I can see, in shutting down this well and killing the well because of the freezing temperatures.
Epstein says even though no gas is coming out of the well right now, that could change. Kathy Forrester with the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission calls that highly unlikely. Epstein says the broader question is how a similar scenario would play out offshore. Shell is planning to drill several exploratory wells in the Beaufort and Chukchi Seas this summer. She says a blowout there could be much worse.
If we weren't so lucky and there was ongoing gas or oil release, what are we going to do about the freezing temperatures that are seemingly preventing them from killing the well in a quick time frame?
Shell plans to work into October and will have to deal with freezing conditions. Epstein points out worker safety would be a bigger problem offshore, too. She says it's much harder to evacuate a rig that's leaking gas in the middle of the ocean. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Chief Justice Walter Carpinetti today took the opportunity of his final address to the legislature to ask lawmakers to consider some alternatives to the judicial systems that have developed in the state. He referred to a new concept called smart justice that considers the possible result of every action taken by the justice system. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Chief Justice Carpinetti told legislators that the criminal justice system, at all levels, in every case, needs to consider the cost of its actions on the system's resources, on public safety, and on the potential for all citizens.
In practice, it means making criminal justice decisions that reserve our most costly response to crime, prison time, for those cases where other less costly alternatives will not effectively protect the public or rehabilitate the perpetrator.
The major point of the address was a call to include the judiciary in tailoring prison or treatment sentences to offenders. He said that many people presume a judge is able to consider risk and rehabilitation when sentencing a convict.
Indeed, under our current law, judges are generally required to take an offender's prospects for rehabilitation into account. But the modern reality of the sentencing process is much different from the assumption. Under our state's presumptive sentencing laws, in place since 1978, the judge's role in sentencing is actually quite limited.
He says the reality of a vast majority of cases allows judges only to approve or disapprove a sentence already worked out between prosecution and defense attorneys. He called it superficial control and said he often felt like an observer in a case, not a participant.
The old adage of if you can do the crime, you can do the time, is appealing on a gut level, and it has driven our criminal justice thinking for many years. It sounds tough, it rings true, and it seems only fair. But as we now know, the idea that jail time is the fitting response to every crime, or even to most crimes, has become an expensive and a possibly unnecessary proposition.
Carpinetti said the presumptive sentencing laws were written before there were studies and techniques available to predict criminal activity or to rehabilitate offenders. He quoted the Chief Justice of the Missouri Supreme Court.
There is a better way. We need to move from anger-based sentencing that ignores cost and effectiveness to evidence-based sentencing that focuses on results.
Senate Judiciary Chairman Hollis French said the speech reinforced some of the work done in the legislature. He said his focus has been on reviewing the increasing number of nonviolent offenders who are put in prison. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Anchorage inches closer to the season snowfall record.
You know, an inch here, an inch there adds up pretty quickly, and we only need about 13 inches to set the bar at a new level.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Enjoy high school hoops in Anchorage during the 2012 ASAA March Madness State Basketball Championships, March 12th through 17th. Come early and stay late to enjoy Anchorage's big wildlife with events, shopping, dining, and activities for the whole family. For more information on what to see and do in Anchorage, explore anchorage.net/Alaskans, your source for Anchorage information. This message sponsored by Visit Anchorage.
Last year, Alaska's congressional delegation fought hard to keep the Essential Air Service program alive. They argued that without it, more than 40 Alaskan communities could lose the planes that connect them to the rest of the state. Ultimately, the program was saved, and its funding was even bumped up to $143 million. But as KUCB's Alexandra Gutierrez reports, the Department of Transportation is still trying to rein in program costs, and the city of Adak may see air travel to the community change as a result.
Twice a week, Alaska Airlines flies a Boeing 737 jet to Adak. The plane is capable of carrying 132 passengers, or just about half of the town's population. It's been making the voyage for almost a decade now, but this June, it's expected to see its final run. According to city manager Layden Lockett, Alaska Airlines won't be submitting a bid for Essential Air Service, or EAS, to Adak this year. He says that's because the Department of Transportation is responding to federal budget pressure and working to reduce ADAC's subsidy. With fuel costs rising, Alaska Airlines wouldn't be able to bring their bid low enough to qualify for the funding. Currently, the airline is receiving a $1.6 million subsidy every year to operate the flight. That leaves the community of ADAC in a bit of a lurch. Lockett says that the community relies on the flight for more than just travel.
That's how we get all of our groceries. We don't have regular barge service or ferry service at all. We receive all of our perishable products on that plane. And, you know, that is a concern if a plane can't make it or if it's continuously delayed by weather, what that can do.
The Department of Transportation is taking bids on the Anchorage to Adak route through March 9th, and they're expected to announce the winner by the end of April. Penn Air has bid on the route in the past, and they're one of the likely contenders to take it over. The airline is a primary operator in Southwest Alaska, and it already serves the EIS communities of Atka and Nikolski. Penn Air President Danny Siebert says that if their bid is successful, the company will probably fly a 30-person Saab turboprop plane to Adak from Cold Bay. Since they would have less space for cargo and a smaller passenger load, Penn Air would have to operate the flight 4 or 5 times a week, something that Siebert says would be impossible without the EIS subsidy.
We're going to lose money on EDAC. So what the government will do will reimburse us our losses, plus give us a 5% profit margin.
City Manager Layden Lockett says that the increase in service would benefit ADAC, but he's concerned that the smaller planes might struggle more with ADAC's weather and that the community would have a harder time getting its groceries in. He also anticipates that ticket prices will go up for ADAC's residents and the seafood processors who come out to work there. He adds that without the EAS subsidy, it wouldn't be economically viable to travel out to ADAC.
You know, without it, I'm sure we would be looking at double or triple the fare. Right now, we pay $1,500 round trip to go to Anchorage, and I mean, I know we're going to see an increase, probably in the $2,000 range. But you know, without the subsidy, we would be looking at $3,000 tickets pretty easily.
If there are no successful bids for the ADAC route, Alaska Airlines has reassured city officials that they would come up with an arrangement to continue service to the community. An Alaska Airlines spokesperson confirmed that the contract for the route expires on June 30th, but wasn't able to provide further comment at this time. In Unalaska, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Yesterday, in the first of a two-part series, APRN's Steve Heimel reported on ocean acidification being observed along the shores of the West Coast. Acidification was found at the edge of the continental shelf in 2007, but this is the first time it's been found in the rich intertidal zone close to shore. Alaska's ocean acidification is largely unmeasured. That's likely to change now. In today's story, Heimel looks at the circulation patterns that may already be acidifying fish habitat in the Arctic.
Increasing levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are making the ocean more acid, or more accurately, less alkaline. The most common way to measure acidity is the pH scale, where 7 is neutral and any lower number is acid. And the current pH of the ocean is about 8, but is thought to have been about 8.15 before CO2 levels began increasing back in 1800. Scientists have been predicting a pH of 7.9 by 2050, but it may be happening faster than that. Upwelling deep water from the Pacific is now being reliably measured just offshore in Washington, Oregon, California, and Mexico as low as 7.6 by University of Oregon researcher Bruce Menge. Now, that is an extreme of a great deal of daily variability, but Menge says the downward trend is clear. He's not ready to say what might be happening in Arctic waters.
The actual mechanisms for creating low pH water vary with where you are in the ocean. And what's going to happen in Alaska is different. It happens in a different way from what happens along the coast from Washington down through Baja California.
One researcher who has been looking at Alaska waters is Fiona McLaughlin of Canada's Department of Fisheries and Oceans. She was part of the International Polar Year icebreaker voyages in the Canada Basin in Beaufort Gyre, and her team did measure low pH on the surface and in the colder, deep waters of the Arctic, a finding she reported last year. In a scientific analysis now out, she and University of Alaska Fairbanks professor Eddie Carmack find several sources for the growing acidity of Arctic waters. They prefer to use a measurement known as omega, which relates to the calcium carbonate saturation state of seawater. Omega 1 is the point at which the shells of ocean creatures have no risk of dissolving. Waters below omega 1 mean organisms have trouble maintaining or building shells. Low omega water already exists in the deep ocean due to pressure and at the surface due to carbon dioxide absorption. But it also arrives in the upper part of the ocean in the form of increasing runoff from land. And now there's yet another source, because every summer since 2007, the sea ice has been melting back past the continental shelf.
Then we add on top very low omega water because of ice melt. Then we've melted the ice sufficiently northward beyond the shelf break. Upwelling winds bring this low omega water that's located at 150 meters under storm conditions up onto the shelf and affect the benthic organisms like clams and mussels. There are many forces converging at the same time affecting Arctic waters.
Down in the tropics, low omega waters are already washing onto coral reefs from time to time, adding to other damages brought about by pollution, ecosystem changes, and rising ocean levels. At this point, 87% of the coral reefs in the Caribbean are dead from this combination of factors. This is a heartbreaking situation for divers and researchers who remember what the reefs were originally like. Bruce Menge says it's hard to watch this happen.
I used to work in coral systems a bit, and I don't anymore. I don't even want to go there because of the effects that warming has had on them and now acidification is clearly having on corals. That's going to happen elsewhere, too, and that's very depressing.
The relationship between rising carbon dioxide and rising acidity is inexorable. All that is in doubt is the circulation and what will happen as sea life adapts to an ocean growing more acid. In Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
Ultra-energy-efficient building is possible and makes sense. That's the focus of a course called A 21st Century Sustainable Home at University of Alaska Fairbanks coming this Saturday. It's taught by Cooperative Extension Service Sustainability Coordinator Rich Seifert, author of A Solar Design Manual for Alaska. Seifert says it all starts with super-insulated walls, doors, and windows.
Get the house as energy efficient as possible, so it has to use as little energy as possible to keep you in that warm tropical savanna that you want to live in. And then add the solar amenities, the windows, the solar hot water, to get you through that period around the winter solstice when you just simply can't get anything else. The best option we found is a masonry wood stove to burn the wood as fast and hot and pollution-free as possible.
Seifert says two such homes built in Fairbanks in recent years have proven that a near-zero net energy house is possible in the interior. The homes rely on storing a large quantity of solar-heated water. The homes are not cheap to build, but Seifert says long-term savings make up the difference.
Invest the capital in the energy efficiency in the house up front, similar to what you do with all renewables, and then you never have to buy that fuel again.
Seifert says contractors are trying to bring down the cost of building the sustainable house by modularizing components.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. And by the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com.
Anchorage is on track to break the total snowfall record for the season. As of today, 119.9 inches had fallen in the city. The record is 132.8 inches, set back in the winter of 1954-55. And National Weather Service meteorologist Dave Snyder says there is more snow in the forecast.
You know, an inch here, an inch there adds up pretty quickly. And like I said, we only need about 13 inches to set the bar at a new level.
The average snowfall for March and April combined is 14 inches. Snyder says it's been a fun winter to be a meteorologist.
As far as snow goes, it's kind of interesting to see the reaction in the office. Some of us, especially the new people, are cheering the record. We want to go for the most. Others are really, really tired of it. And I think most people, it seems like, that I've run into that are locals and have been locals for a long time are grumbling. They're ready to see a little green grass. So it's certainly a split decision in the office right now.
The snowiest winter ever in Anchorage was followed the next year by the second snowiest winter. Snowfall totals in Anchorage still pale in comparison to Girdwood. Alyeska Ski Resort is reporting 715 inches have fallen since October at the top of the mountain. Avalanches from Mount Juno pose an unacceptable risk to Capital City residents and property. That's the finding of a new report presented to the Juno Assembly this week. The study also recommends the city buy out at-risk homes. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
Consultants from the Swiss Institute for Snow and Avalanche Research looked at Mount Juno's Barrens Avenue and White Subdivision avalanche paths last year. Over the centuries, slides have carved out huge swaths of hillside on the 3,500-foot peak overlooking a pair of neighborhoods near downtown Juno. The report makes clear it's only a matter of time before the next large avalanche impacts one of those neighborhoods, says the city's emergency programs manager, Tom Matisse.
They looked at the history from the early 1900s all the way to present. And in the Barrens Path, they found three avalanches reaching tidewater in 1890, 1826, and in 1962. In 1962, only the wind event reached the tidewater, but in the other two events, snow mass reached the tidewater in great amounts.
The report says the most effective way to reduce the risk of avalanches from the Barrens Path is to have the city buy out homes in the neighborhoods below and prohibit development there. Other measures, such as snow dams and retaining walls near houses or snow-supporting structures on the hillside, are too expensive and might not protect the neighborhood. The report says they could be effective in the White Subdivision, which contains fewer homes, but there would need to be more study. Likewise, Matisse says the consultants do not recommend using explosives to artificially release snow on Mount Juno.
With the mean inclination of both 34 and 35 degrees, those are very, very active avalanche paths. The worst case scenario is we'd try and start a small avalanche. The avalanche zones connect to one another. We'd end up with a large avalanche, and we'd be buying the houses.
The report recommends the buyout, which would include at least 28 homes, be done in phases, targeting the most at-risk properties first. Matisse says the same Federal Emergency Management Agency grant that paid for the avalanche mitigation report could pay for a buyout.
At this point in time, the recommendation would be to approach the residents in Area 1, determine their level of interest, and after you've gained level of interest, you could determine fair market value on those properties, then use that fair market value to form cost-benefit analysis to apply for the grants for that first step.
The buyout idea has been floated to city officials in the past, and while the Assembly did not commit to any course of action, Assemblywoman Karen Crane said she hopes this report will not be ignored.
I just hope this doesn't end up another report. We've had several along the way that ends up on the shelf, and that we can find a path to take some action here.
At a minimum, the report recommends mandatory evacuations and road closures when avalanche danger is most severe. The consultants say Juno Douglas High School, which is near the bottom of the Barrens Path, would not sustain any damage, even from the largest possible avalanche. In Juno, I'm Casey Kelly.
The Alaska Moose Federation has been given the go-ahead to begin a moose relocation program in the Anchorage and Matanuska and Susitna Valley areas. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Dale Rabe is Fish and Game's Deputy Director of Wildlife Conservation. He says the Alaska Moose Federation was not granted the temporary permit lightly.
A permit was issued to the Alaska Moose Federation, which was the culmination of months of discussion and work to provide insurance that the things that would happen through the program that they've proposed would be safe and responsible for both the animals and the people that would be involved with that.
Rabe calls the new arrangement an experiment. Earlier, Fish and Game had authorized the Moose Federation to set up feeding stations for moose, which are having a hard time finding food in this year's deep snow and are congregating near highways.
The permit requires the Moose Federation to contract with the Federal Department of Agriculture's Wildlife Services Program to do the work because Federation volunteers do not have the professional training as biologists to be able to sedate animals. Rave says the program will occur under the oversight of Fish and Game, and he stresses that the reason behind the new permit is to keep roadways safe for drivers and for moose.
The program itself, from the state's perspective, is intended to try to bring some measure of improvement to the wildlife vehicle accidents that happen every winter, and this winter is particularly bad.
The Moose Federation's Gary Olson was not available for comment for this story, but longtime moose biologist Vic Van Ballenberg has reservations about the program.
Well, it might be a good idea under some circumstances, but there's a number of logistical problems with doing it. First of all, where do you relocate the moose to? This is a deep snow winter pretty much over the entirety of South Central Alaska, and you know, if you take a moose and you want to release it somewhere else where it stands a chance of better surviving, it's very hard to find a place like that.
Questions remain as to why the state legislature has failed to provide funding for Fish and Game to do the work while allowing a nonprofit to contract with a federal agency to handle state-owned wildlife. Rabe says in the past efforts by his department to get additional funds had failed, while the Moose Federation has scored legislative grants of about $1.2 million.
So we're interested in the aspect of a novel approach to try and see whether or not it's effective and at some point cost effective to capture animals and then move them to another site and then see whether or not they'll stay away from the roads for the balance of the winter. So we are treating this as an experiment.
The permit for moose relocation runs from February 28th to March 31st. It's expected that 10 moose could be relocated. And Rabe says he is aware that one goal of the Moose Federation is to have a sustainable moose population in the region for hunters. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Casey Kelly in Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2012 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska. 8 hours after you quit smoking, your blood oxygen level returns to normal. In 3 months, your lung function improves up to 30%. And 10 years after you quit, your risk of dying from lung cancer is about half that of a smoker. But right now, you're one cigarette closer to cancer. Every cigarette makes you sick. So quit smoking today. Information at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. Timing is everything. A mother who waits until her child is at least 2 years old before becoming pregnant again has a better chance of regaining strength and energy between pregnancies. Her baby is more likely to be born on time and at a good weight. So talk to your health care provider to find out how to plan your pregnancies and ask for the state's free birth spacing booklet. Take the time to build a strong and healthy family. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.